All right, would the clerk please call the calendar to order?
Good morning. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Larkin, Judge Hooten, Judge Smith, the Honorable Michelle A. Larkin presiding.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals, the seventh day of July, 2021. We are scheduled for three hearings this morning on the Zoom platform. I believe each of the attorneys has appeared on this platform before. We'll ask you to simply be mindful of the timekeeping mechanism up in the left-hand corner of the screen, and also watch for questions from the judges. They may interrupt you if necessary. We will give each of you a minute or so to state your primary position and the issues that you feel are most important. We are familiar with the facts of the case, so it's not necessary to focus on those. And if we have questions about the facts, we'll ask. With that, I'd invite counsel for appellant in the first case, which is State of Minnesota versus Brian John. Is it Leonida or Leonida? How do we pronounce it?
Leonida, Your Honor.
Leonida. Well, I did that wrong each way. My apologies to your client. Would you introduce yourself for the record and begin your argument, please?
Thank you. May it please the court. My name is John Donovan. I'm an assistant state public defender, and I represent the appellant in this case, Brian Leonida. Defendants in Minnesota have a right to an impartial judge at all stages of a proceeding. A defendant is denied that right if a judge independently investigates facts not in evidence. A defendant is also denied that right if the judge announces the results of that investigation and introduces facts favorable to the state before the state introduces those facts. Instead, a judge should either disqualify themselves or set that extrajudicial knowledge aside when making a decision. In this case, Mr. Leonida violated a no-contact order and between plea and sentencing, picked up a new charge for the same offense in a different county. At the time of sentencing, he made a motion for a downward durational departure, and the district court denied that motion, stating, and then you had that new Dakota County case come out. And I went into that file to see, okay, is that pending? What's happening? I read the complaint and the allegations therein, again, text messaging, and I have seen that pre-sentence investigation as well.
Can I ask you this? I mean, as I understand it, this information about the additional charge that your client picked up between the time of the plea and the sentencing was already in the PSI. What's new and different here that the judge learned that is that was prejudicial to your client?
What the judge learned is that this new charge involved the same behavior, text messaging. Nowhere else in the record in either the PSI or in the violation report for his conditional release does it state the nature of that new contact. It just says that
Is the fact that it's a text message necessarily prejudicial? Because what if it was in-person contact instead of a text message? Maybe you'd be here probably arguing that this was not the same conduct. And it was a more, and the state would be arguing it's a more intrusive type of conduct. So how is this prejudicial to your client? I come back to my first question.
It's prejudicial to the client because the judge highlights it. I agree that I might be saying something different if it was in person, but the judge is highlighting this again, text message. He's pointing it out and then immediately says, so I'm going to put this all in a context, which is sort of error on issue two, but putting that aside for now, and saying that you're repeating this behavior in the same way.
But didn't the judge also warn your client that he can't have any additional violations? So obviously he was concerned about this being an issue.
True, but
And so any type of violation, wouldn't it have been contrary to what was warned about by the judge?
It would have been contrary to what the judge warned about, but it's still irrelevant to the actual decision because what we're talking about here is a durational departure. And so really the judge sets himself up to fail right at the plea hearing, because at the plea hearing, he even says, this is text. It's different kind of violation. I understand that you're in the hunt for this departure, but I want to see how you're doing. But there's no actual agreement. So it's not as if this new charge violates an agreement. It was just he could make that argument at sentencing. But then come sentencing, the judge is saying, okay, there's more. So this offense is now no longer less serious. I'm not going to grant the departure. But that conduct didn't matter because it didn't affect the seriousness of the offense. The seriousness was finished essentially on November 28, 2018. I see there's a question.
There is. Thank you, counsel. I feel like we're moving into the second issue. And before we do that, I have a question on the first issue, the allegation that the judge violated the code of conduct or acted in a matter that indicated partiality by looking at the case file, a district court file in another case, another county. Mm-hmm. I mean, as a district court judge, I know how this works. And as a former public defender, Your client's record is before the court, whether it's, you know, another case in this county, another state. I mean, sort of the notion that, well, you have to put blinders on and you can't look at any other court files concerning this individual seems like a departure from Dorsey. Now, I know you cited a non-precedential case in which this court said, well, you can't look at a PSI. I'm not clear, but was that a PSI concerning the defendant in that case or a co-defendant's PSI?
In the unpublished case, it was a co-defendant's PSI. Okay.
So do we have any other case where a court has said a judge steps outside the boundaries of proper judicial conduct by looking at a defendant's file in another case at the time of sentencing?
There's not one that has that explicit holding, but that would still run afoul of Dorsey, because I take your point that sort of his whole record is before the court, but the complaint in the Dakota County file is not actually a part of this record. If you go through what's in the record,
let me ask you this. Sure. I agree. Those are the facts. So that is different. But another thing that's different in my view between the facts here and the facts in Dorsey and the two non-precedential cases you've cited is that this isn't a contested fact. I mean, no one is arguing that he has a new charge. He pleaded guilty to the new charge. The new charge involved a text message. I mean, in all these other cases, it seems that the fact that the judge found or took notice of was in fact contested by the defendant. Is that significant?
It's not significant. I think in this case, it was a situation in which they're sort of past the point of contesting facts, because prior to that, the state never introduced that there was a new text message or what's in that file. No one actually discussed that it was a new text message. The defendant has spoken. And at this point, the judge is just making the decision. And he's saying there was text messages again. And immediately in the next sentence, or I think two sentences later, says, I'm denying the departure. So they're sort of past the point of contesting facts. It's too late.
Well, how would you contest the facts? How is there any harm here? You can't contest that he had a new charge. He pleaded guilty. The charge was OFP violation based on a text message.
Because
there's nothing to contest.
The fact you just said at the end is not in this record, that it's a text message. That does not appear in the record in this case until the judge says it. There's nowhere in the PSI where it says it was another text message. And I think maybe the other point to one of your earlier questions about going through a file, knowing that there's this charge, knowing that he pled guilty in Dakota County, it's fair game. I won't dispute knowing that it's part of the violation report. It's part of the PSI. He goes through, he looks into that complaint, he reads that complaint, and then he goes through that PSI and he reads the PSI, and we don't know what's in a PSI. And I think that's actually a bit more egregious. Those are very confidential documents. They're confidential to the point where if Mr. Leonarda called me and asked me for a copy of his PSI, I'm not actually permitted to give it to him.
But are you saying a district court can't look at its own records? I mean, the PSI is prepared by order of court and filed with the district court. Are you saying it's so confidential that the district court can't look at it?
The district court could look at, in this case, Judge Meslow could look at the Washington County PSI, but he couldn't go to a Dakota County file in a case that's not before him and read that PSI. I don't think that's permissible under the statute. I think that these are considered private, confidential information that you just can't go and access. But I think maybe even more importantly, the rule in Dorsey says we're not putting a limit on is this okay, is that okay? All investigations are off the table. I mean,
so really, counsel, can I ask apropos of that? Are you arguing, and I'm not sure I saw this in a briefing, is this a Is this subject to a structural error this analysis? Is. Okay, so you're arguing that if there's a, irrespective of what impact the new information would have, there must be a reversal because it was structural error. Is that right?
That is correct.
And so, but you're acknowledging, I think, let's say that the information about the fact that the contact was a text was not included. And instead, what was simply included is that there was a charge, there was a guilty plea, et cetera. You're not arguing that that, I mean, you're saying that that already would have been known in this case. I'm trying to understand, like, well, if it's a structural error, how do you distinguish between stuff that was already known versus this new piece of data that you're saying was not known and therefore it must be reversed, even though it would have, may have had no impact on this case?
If all that happened in this case was the judge just said, and sticking with issue one on this point, if the judge said, I see there's a new charge, I see it's for the same offense, I see you pled guilty, I'm going to deny your departure, I wouldn't have an argument. That I would then talk about argument two.
And that would be because he would see it from the PSI already in this very case? Or would it have been a problem to have gone into the other file and see that he was charged with something and pleaded? Would that be an improper investigation to go into the other county file and see that?
I think that would be an improper investigation as well. If he were to just, you know, look at, say, Mensis, I think he's still then gone and looked into facts. But he goes farther than that, in that he is reading the complaint and he's reading the PSI. And so the depth of what he learned, if the only thing that he learned was that this was a text message, all the other information was identical, he still investigated a fact, not an evidence. And Mr. Leonida is therefore entitled to automatic reversal. It's structural error. We've discussed prejudice in response to questions, but he doesn't need to show prejudice. There's no limit on what that investigation is. As soon as he investigates it, it doesn't matter if a judge drives from International Falls all the way down to Stillwater, or if a judge Googles a death date, automatic reversal is required.
Automatic reversal of the sentence?
Yes.
Where does that get you then? I mean, let's be realistic.
He would get resentencing in front of a new judge, in front of a different judge, and could then again make his departure request that this was a less serious offense warranting a downward durational departure.
And what happens in that case when the county attorney brings all of this before the judge at sentencing? I'm just playing this out for you.
If it comes before the judge in sentencing and we have this whole thing again, then the state is the one introducing this fact, because that's sort of the three things that Dorsey is talking about. The third one is the judge has introduced a fact favorable to the state that the state did not introduce. If we go back for resentencing and all of this plays out again, I think that, again, my argument's sort of the same, in that the offense, how serious the offense was, hasn't changed since November 28th. It's for subsequent courts. But then that would be different because it's not the judge independently investigating something. The state has presented that.
So to understand then just what your analysis you would have us employ, where did the mistake happen by the judge, the error? Into another file or reading too much in another file? So if we have an example where the prosecutor didn't, for whatever reason, raise this other guilty plea in the other case, it would be error for the district court, who, I don't know, heard about it, to look in Mensis and see that this other case even existed. Like, where's the mistake?
That would be an error as well. I think that's sort of what Dorsey is. The only fact that's investigated is confirming when someone died. That's something very small. It's not even a sort of main character in the case. It's a peripheral character. It's who a different witness bought a couch from. But that small of an investigation was structural error. So if nothing about this...
But again, counsel, that was in the context of a trial to the court where the judge was the fact finder and the judge went out and did the investigation and used that extra record information to make a finding that a witness for the defense was not credible. I mean, I get that Dorsey has some broad language, and that there's a basis for you to argue that that broad language applies here, but these are very different facts. I think just common sense says when a judge is sentencing someone in a criminal case, the judge should know about everything that's going on with this defendant, including that the defendant has committed a new crime and pleaded guilty to that crime prior to sentencing. That's not the sort of information I think that practitioners would say a district court judge should not have access. So it seems to be the only, you know, real complaint here is that, you know, the PSI informed the district court judge there's a new charge, he's pleaded guilty, it's in Dakota County. You know, the one step too far is, oh, it was based on a text message. I'm having a hard time finding that a judge violated the Code of Judicial Conduct by reading a complaint when all the information about the existence of the complaint, the charge, the plea, and the offense, at least what type of offense it was put before the judge in the PSI.
And to respond, and I think I might, because I'm almost out of time, but I would like to offer an answer to that question. I think
please
I might
do.
Run over. I take your point, and I think the state's point in the brief, that we are in a different procedural phase here. That was, Dorsey was in a trial, and now we're talking about sentencing. But we are still talking about the judge acting as a fact finder, because we're talking about this in a departure context. I think we normally think of this more with aggravated departures, where you have aggravating facts and aggravating factors. It's true in a mitigated departure as well, because it's just that you don't have that jury trial right. So the judge still needs to find mitigating facts and mitigating factors. And so he's still called upon to act as a fact finder. It might be different if we're talking about a presumptive sentence somewhere in the range. In this case, he needed to find facts. He made a factual finding that this was not less serious based on a fact that he learned outside of the record. And so he was still acting as a fact finder. And so he's still, even putting the code of conduct aside, have that constitutional right to have an impartial judge. And that's what warrants the automatic reversal here.
Counsel, following up on that, and I'd like you to address this on rebuttal. It goes to your second argument. We can discuss it then. A judge is required to find facts to do an upward departure. My understanding of the law is a judge is not required to find any facts to deny a departure. I mean, a judge would need to find facts to grant a downward or an upward. But a judge can simply say, I've considered the reasons for and against departure. I'm not doing a departure. The end. The judge doesn't need to make any factual findings. The judge doesn't need to provide any explanation. The judge can just deny it. So it's not as if the judge needed to find facts to deny this departure. So I'm again having a hard time understanding why this matters. I mean, if the judge found facts in support of a departure and did so in this method, I would expect the state to say, hey, wait a minute, you're fact finding in support of a departure. You shouldn't be looking around for facts to do that. But again, here, it's a presumptive sentence. Why was any fact finding necessary? Maybe you could address that on rebuttal.
Absolutely, Your Honor. Thank you.
And at this point, we'll hear for counsel for the state. Would you introduce yourself for the record before presenting your argument, please?
Yes. Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Nick Hajdukovich. I'm an assistant Washington County attorney, and I represent the respondent, State of Minnesota. The state is asking that this court affirm the appellant's sentence in this case. The two primary reasons are that the information Judge Mesler learned from the Dakota County PSI was, first, not disputed, and second, not material. And those distinctions are significant. In the cases cited in the briefs, as well as discussed at argument today, all of the cases involved facts that appeared to be both contested and material. In fact, in Dorsey, the Supreme Court, at page 251 of its opinion, held that the judge's investigation, quote, effectively introduced into the proceedings a material fact that was favorable to the state, end quote. And that introduction of a material fact favorable to the state deprived Dorsey of his right to a fair trial by an impartial trier of fact.
I'm sorry if I may interrupt. So would you argue that structural error is not the appropriate standard if a judge investigates outside the record?
What I think is that I think that the structural error is the standard I think that Dorsey sets forth, but it's not enough to say that because a judge did an investigation, that structural error would therefore apply and result in a reversal. When the structural error comes into play is if the judge not only doesn't their own investigation, but introduces those facts, and those facts are material and probably need to be actually disputed facts as well. The materiality language is directly from the Dorsey case. So if all of those conditions exist, then I think there would be an error, and then structural error would entail reversal. But the error only exists, I think, if all of those conditions I just articulated exist. So we don't get to the reversal until that point. The mere access of another court file isn't sufficient.
Would you agree that a judge investigating on his or her own, doing an independent investigation is unethical and not allowed under our law?
Well,
as a general proposition?
In many instances, yes. What the actual Code of Judicial Conduct, specifically Canon 2.09c, says is that a judge shall not investigate facts in a matter independently and shall consider only the evidence presented and any facts that may be properly judicially noticed. And so I think then that brings us to the question of what facts are properly judicially noticed, and I suppose what constitutes an independent investigation. Whereas here, almost every fact, and as I would argue, every material fact is contained within the record in this case.
Are you claiming that this was a judicial notice of the charge and the plea and the complaint based on what was publicly available in the file?
I think that's one argument that can be made, and in support of that, and I would note that the appellant actually asked the court to, at a previous hearing, to consider his Dakota County PSI, to actually use that PSI. That was on March 13th, 2020, that transcript at pages 3 through 4. The appellant appeared in court on a conditional release violation because of that new Dakota County file. And his attorney at that hearing actually asked the court to use that Dakota County PSI. I believe I'm inferring from that it was, the purpose would be to expedite the PSI process. Are you
that the judge could judicially notice the PSI, are you?
I'm not claiming that the judge could judicially notice the PSI without that request made by the defendant, because I think it has to be made available to both sides before a fact can be judicially noticed. I'm sorry.
So are you arguing there wasn't an independent investigation because the defendant asked the judge to look at the Dakota County PSI?
You know, I guess I hadn't considered it in those terms before, to be perfectly honest, but I guess that makes sense.
That's very different than what happened in Dorsey in the other cases where a judge goes off on his or her own and starts reading other files or doing investigation. I mean, are you telling us, and I'll ask defense counsel to confirm this, that there was actually a request by appellant that the district court access and rely upon the Dakota County PSI?
Yes. What I will say in all candor, however, is that request was made to a different judge than Judge Meslow. It was a different judge presiding that day at that hearing. And I don't have any specific knowledge of whether Judge Meslow was aware of that request. But I think at the very least, it goes to whether this was an impermissible investigation that would demonstrate bias, which is ultimately the issue. If the appellant wanted this information considered, it would seem difficult to say that that was some sort of impermissible bias, regardless of whether Judge Meslow actually knew of the request or not.
Is that transcript part of our record at which that request was made?
Yes. Yes. It's the March 13th, 2020 transcript at pages 3 through 4.
And is this an argument you made in your brief that...
It is not. It's not something that occurred to me at the time. I was simply noting it in response to the question. So, and I'm not trying to make any new legal argument based on that, because I recognize I didn't raise it in my brief. I'm just using it as support for various propositions that I'm being asked about here.
The thing I'm struggling with is the distinction between a recognition that investigation outside the record, if is subject to a structural error, and then while only if it's material and prejudicial. Those sound like incompatible ideas to me.
I think that the reason I struggled with that a little bit in preparation for this argument too, and I think the way to reconcile that is that The question isn't just, was there an independent investigation? The fact of an impermissible independent investigation is what would constitute, in the Dorsey case, for example, Dorsey being deprived of the right to a fair trial by an impartial trier of fact. So essentially what the court is saying there is that the nature of this independent investigation, based on material facts, et cetera, made essentially this judge biased, regardless of the judge's intent at the time. And therefore, once we have that bias, structural error comes into play. But I don't think it's enough to say that looking at another court file, it per se requires reversal, because I just don't think that's supported by the law. But I agree that there's some tension.
Could you talk a little bit about structural error? I'm going from memory here. So, I mean, is structural error a concept that's limited to proceedings at trial? Does structural error extend to sentencing?
I think, in candor, that the answer is probably yes, because I think in the same way, because the issue is, with structural error, can a court really determine whether there was any prejudice. And if there is a biased judge at the time of sentencing, I think it's fair to say that, you know, we can't determine that. And there's case law that I didn't cite in my brief, and I'm not making this as a separate legal argument, but there are cases that distinguish between a situation where there's a demonstration of actual bias versus maybe a perception of bias, and that is not reviewed for structural error. And so the cases seem to distinguish between those two things. But here, counsel, as I understand it, is arguing that there was actual bias exhibited. And under those circumstances, my understanding of the case law is that the structural error standard would apply.
But I thought structural error was such a violation of a defendant's due process rights, that it doesn't, that they don't have to prove bias. I mean, because it's just, that's why it's structural error, because we've had an effect for most errors as to whether they're harmless or whether there's bias, but structural error is a whole different ballgame, isn't it?
It is, but I think the difference here is that, I think we have to just distinguish between bias in terms of a judge being biased and causing prejudice or causing harm to a party as a result of that. And the bias here is a precondition to getting to reversal. That is, there's no essentially due process violation unless there's a demonstration that the judge was biased in their decision making. And if that demonstration has been made, then there doesn't need to be a further demonstration of prejudice, because essentially I think what the courts would say is that if you have a biased judge, it's sort of impossible to parse out that information. I think you're muted, Judge Larkin.
Of course I am, and I'm sorry, I'm looking at Westlaw as well as you people. I mean, I'm just looking at the Supreme Court's explanation, our Supreme Court's explanation of structural error in Dahlbeck, which it quotes heavily from the United States Supreme Court. I mean, the language really does indicate that structural error is a trial error. Structural error consists of defects in the constitution of the trial mechanism, which defy analysis by harmless error standards, because the entire conduct of the trial from beginning to end is obviously affected. Structural error affects the framework within which the trial proceeds rather than simply an error in the trial process itself. Structural error represents a very limited class of errors. I mean, frankly, if it were a situation where it was a contested sentencing hearing where people were calling witnesses, and that does sometimes occur, we might feel a little bit closer to Dorsey and structural error analysis in my view, but I'm having a hard time saying that structural error analysis should apply at a sentencing hearing where there is not any issue of contested fact put before the court for decision. I'm not seeing that Dorsey's a great
fit here.
And I would agree with that, Your Honor. Absolutely. I agree that Dorsey is not a good fit here for many reasons, but I think that goes past the question of whether we get to structural error because we don't have the error in the first instance. And that's under Dorsey because there's nothing material. I think Judge Hooten asked the question of opposing counsel about, you know, the fact that these are text messages. The appellant's theory and what Judge Meslow had sort of implied at the plea hearing as well is that, as a general matter, a text message violation of a no contact order may be less serious than other violations, such as an in-person violation.
Do you agree with that?
I think that it can be, but I think it's very fact specific. And these typically come about, as this one did, in the context of a domestic relationship. And as I think many of us have seen throughout the years with domestic related cases, these never occur in a vacuum. You know, there's always these dynamics happening. That's why we have, for example, the relationship evidence statute. And because we need to illustrate those dynamics. I don't know that I agree with that, but I think that I think it just depends on the facts. It may be. I think, Judge Smith, you have a question.
Thank you. So let's imagine that the district court did the same thing, went into the other file, read a complaint that it had a whole heap of information that wasn't actually pleaded to, you know, but enough in the guilty plea. They didn't look at the guilty plea to sort of separate out, you know, what was pleaded, what was admitted to, and what wasn't. So there's a lot of negative information in the complaint. And let's posit, you know, a situation where there's also a ton of other additional information in the PSI that the court looked at. I mean, I think here for the defendant, the problem is that there's this incremental little bit more that the fact that it was a text, but let's just posit for purposes of argument that there was a lot of negative information. And the district court didn't explain how it affected it one way or another, but just denied it. Has there been an error by the district court in investigating it? And because you usually make the error before you know what you're going to see, that's where the materiality becomes sort of difficult for me to figure out why that's a structural error component. So if you could speak to that.
Sure. I think that whether it violates the Code of Judicial Conduct 2.09C, it may. But that doesn't necessarily lead to reversal, because I think what Dorsey says is that if the judge had set that aside, not announced it and not considered it, there would not be any error of any significance. And that makes sense because, I mean, judges are going to know things even without sometimes investigating that are outside of the record that may be relevant to the case. And their ability to set that aside is important. So I don't think there'd be any error in the sense of in these particular judicial proceedings had those been the facts. Maybe the judge violated the canon of judicial conduct, arguably, but that in and of itself doesn't make the judge biased.
And that's, if I may, I know you're running out of time, Judge Larkin, if this is okay. Where is the error in that? What makes that situation I described, where did the error happen that you're conceding might have happened?
Well, I'm not conceding that there would be any error. Let's say it had happened in this case. I'm not conceding that there would be any judicially cognizable error. Like I said, the judge may arguably have violated the strict text of the Code of Judicial Conduct, but that in and of itself doesn't make the judge biased. And that's the error being alleged here. Because as the court in Dorsey said, had the judge set aside the facts that they learned, there wouldn't have been any error. But the fact is the judge announced the facts and used those facts. And those facts were material and disputed and significant.
Doesn't that get at the conflict Judge Smith identifies? I mean, on one hand, Dorsey says this is structural error. But on the other hand, Dorsey says it's structural error because the judge didn't set it aside. The judge relied on it. I mean, if it's truly structural error, it doesn't matter. It's just error. We can't assess the extent to which it impacted judicial decision making. So it's sort of like that structural error tension is in Dorsey itself, because they gave an explanation that says this might not be structural error in another case, depending on what the judge does with it, which seems inconsistent with the definition of structural error.
I see what you're saying, and I don't disagree with you at all. I've been trying to make my argument within the confines of Dorsey, since we're bound by it here. But I agree that the case itself does contain tension. And I thought about that as I was preparing for this argument. I don't necessarily have a great answer other than perhaps the best way to try to reconcile it is to say that the error only occurs if it's material and disputed facts. But again, I agree that that's essentially saying the same thing as it's prejudicial. And I don't know conceptually how to satisfactorily distinguish between those two concepts. I've just been trying to argue within the confines of that case because I think it's relevant to where we are here. I agree. It's frankly not a great fit because at the end of the day, Judge Maslow did not exhibit bias that would require him to disqualify himself. I ask the court to affirm, unless there's further questions.
Can I ask one more question?
Of course you may,
Judge Larkin. I just want to understand because it's a little confusing now. Because as I understand structural error, if you find structural error, analysis is over. But you're saying, no, there's some modification of that. And I guess I'm not understanding exactly what you're claiming should be the law in this area.
Well, what I think the law is under Dorsey and the other cases is that there is structural error if a judge looks outside the record and introduces and relies upon facts that are material and disputed. And if those conditions exist, there is structural error requiring reversal. That's, I think, the best way I can articulate Dorsey. And that may not be entirely satisfactory. I understand that because it is a little bit confusing, frankly. And I think there is some tension there in that language in Dorsey. Given that I think we're bound by it, I don't know what else to do with it, quite honestly.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
We are ready for rebuttal.
Thank you. I have just a few brief points in Judge Larkin. I do want to address the question. I might save that because I maybe want to breeze through a couple of things. One, I disagree with counsel for respondent in treating the three situations in Dorsey as sort of an and. It's not just an independent investigation and announcing that. There were three different ways he was denied an impartial judge. One of them was the investigation. That alone was an error. Then there was also announcing that the results of that, introducing those facts. So it's not just that they both happened. They did both happen here, but any of those is sufficient. And hesitant as I am to sort of wade into, is this structural error? My reading of Dorsey was that Dorsey, it dealt with the rule, said there was no error under the rule or the code of conduct, and then looked at the Constitution. And because it was a constitutional decision is why it was structural error. And I think that's where sort of the conflict comes, because if you look at, I think Schlins is another case. Schlins didn't have structural error because Schlins was dealing with the rule and the code of conduct. So that's why they were looking at harm there. But in Dorsey, when it's a constitutional question of were you denied an impartial judge, that was where structural error came. And Dorsey doesn't limit to just in a trial. Dorsey looked at the Supreme Court in Fulminante and says the Supreme Court has identified two cases in which there is structural error. One of them is when you don't have an impartial judge. And it didn't say at trial, it's just an impartial judge, period. And part of the reasoning for that is the language they say is that without an impartial judge, no criminal punishment may be regarded as fundamentally fair. And so that's what we have here. We have a criminal punishment that's not fundamentally fair if he was denied his right to an impartial judge. And now turning just briefly, Judge Larkin, to the question you posed for rebuttal, I take your point that if a court doesn't have to give its reasons for granting or denying a departure, but when you're in this stage where you're asking for a departure, you're still asking for the judge to make factual findings. He may find that there's nothing there, but he's still being called upon to be a fact finder to determine that. I mean, really, what are trog factors except facts you're asking the judge to find and then applying the departure factor? So he's still being called upon to find facts about this offense. And he then does find facts about this offense. He finds that, you know, typically, as he sort of mentioned before, and he mentions again at sentencing, oftentimes a text message-based violation is less serious. And then he discusses the other facts about the subsequent conduct. So even if he denied the departure, he still found facts.
What do you say to the possibility that appellant himself invited the district court to look at this other PSI and to rely on it for sentencing?
I think if we look in the full context of that rather short hearing, he does say, if you want to just look at Dakota, they then go through and say, okay, there's not actually a PSI completed in Dakota County. So that wasn't completed. So they weren't going to just use that. I read that as taking, if there's a PSI, let's use it here and update it. They say then later on page 5 that there's no PSI in that file. And ultimately in this case, a Washington County corrections agent completed a PSI. So that was then the PSI that the judge should have been using and not going into that other file. Judge Hooten, I think you have a question.
Could I have you address Judge Larkin's question about whether structural error is limited to the trial? I mean, do you know of any cases where structural error has been brought up or been alleged as part of a sentencing hearing?
Other than those unpublished cases, I'm not aware of a published case where they have applied that. But the right is still just to an impartial judge. And I think that's pretty broad language. And if you don't have that impartial judge, even if it's in sentencing, again, as they stated in Dorsey, no criminal punishment can be regarded as fundamentally fair if you have a partial judge. You must have that impartial judge.
How do you define an impartial judge or a partial judge?
I would define an impartial judge. A judge is impartial if they do one of the three things that they did in Dorsey. I think Dorsey laid out three clear guidelines. And one of them is a judge is not partial if they independently investigate a fact, not an evidence. A judge is not impartial if they announce that the results of that investigation rather than disqualifying or setting aside. I think it is possible to have that third one without the second. There could be scenarios if this judge knew right on the money in Dorsey when that one man died and didn't have to look it up. That would be a scenario where they know it, and so they just shouldn't announce it at all, and they should either disqualify themselves and say, I know when that person died, or set it aside and not have it play in the findings. So if one of those two, or also the first one that didn't really come into play here in Dorsey, where you're openly questioning a witness's credibility based on facts that aren't in evidence. If you have one of those three things, the judge is no longer impartial.
Thank you.
Could I ask you this on the judicial notice issue? I mean,
sure.
I mean, since a lot of this information is publicly available, I mean, can't the judge take judicial notice of that? Since anyone could go online and get the same information that the judge obtained, and it should have been clear to your client that the judge would do that.
Well, I don't know that all of it is publicly obtained. That PSI, it would not be publicly attained by someone in there. I don't know if this was to be properly judicial noticed. I think especially in criminal trials, what can be judicially noticed is a bit trickier. The rule explicitly only applies to civil cases, and I believe the advisory committee comments even say it's a little squishy when it comes to criminal matters. But given that
PSI... I mean, if the judge is telling... your case, your client, that you can't have any more crimes, why can't that judge check the record and make sure your client didn't have any more crimes? Because that's a matter of public record that anyone could go to. And in order to do a good job sentencing, wouldn't a judge be expected to do that?
True. And if I may briefly respond, because I know my time is over.
Please do.
Let's say that it was properly judicially noticed. And let's say I lose on issue one. Committing more crimes does not make the offense from November 28th, 2018 any more or less serious. That's where we start getting into, now he's making his decision based on the wrong conduct. That is now offender-related conduct. It was a durational departure, so it could only be based on the offense. So he would therefore be entitled to reversal and resentencing. It wouldn't necessarily have to be in front of a different judge if that were the remedy here, but he would then once again be entitled to be resentencing and with instructions for the judge to properly consider only offense-related factors or facts rather than offender-related, which includes how Mr. Leonida does between the plea and sentencing and if he gets more charges.
Right.
So if there are no further questions, thank you.
Well, it looks like we are well past our time. We appreciate the briefing and the answers to our questions. These are important issues. We will have a decision for you within the 90 days required by statute.